The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace.
Enroll Alabama is a project of AIDS Alabama. For more information, visit the website AIDSAlabama.org. Welcome to another edition of the Healthy Alabama podcast, sponsored by Enroll Alabama. I'm David Person, and Sheila Washington is here with me. Sheila is the founder of the Scottsboro Boys Museum in Scottsboro, Alabama. And if you know any American history or African-American history, you know the story of the Scottsboro Boys in 1931. These nine young men were traveling between Chattanooga and Memphis. They were arrested, pulled from a train and arrested, tried and found guilty of raping two white women, a crime that actually never happened. And that trial helped to launch the modern civil rights movement in our nation. And Ms. Washington's museum has become a repository for that history, paying tribute to the lives of those nine young men and telling their story, the story of this gross racial injustice. Ms. Washington, welcome to the Healthy Alabama podcast, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Mr. Person. Feel that it's an honor to be here with you today to talk about this historical case.
Well, the honor is ours, because what you're doing is you're preserving history. And one thing that I want to start off by asking you a question, and I'm going to set the question up this way. Recently, over the past, I'll say certainly over the past 10 to 15 years, maybe a little bit longer, there's been more talk among black intellectuals and academics about the impact that race and racism have had on the mental health as well as the physical health of African American people in the United States. And I'm one of those who, as I've talked to some of these experts, I agree with them. I think this is true. And so I see museums like yours and like the one down in Montgomery that Brian Stevenson has established, and others that are around the country to some greater or lesser degree examining civil rights and the history of our people, as a way for us to get some closure, some healing, as well as to educate the larger public as to the true story of our people. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the museum is a place of healing of all the wrong that's been done to our people, blacks per se. And in the Scottsboro Boys Museum, I have a lot of whites that come in crying and ask them for forgiveness of the things that their forefathers have done to the blacks. And as far as you said, sickness and different things like that, working on something as big as a museum can cause you to have a lot of stress and sickness to come up on you.
I can imagine, and that's something that we're going to talk about, just the challenges that you faced as you have been on this journey to establish this museum. The museum itself has been open since, what, 2010, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so 9 years old, museum is 9 years old. Before we go into that, though, I want to go back to something you said that I think is very important. You said that there are white people who come in crying, asking for forgiveness for what their ancestors did. As I hear that, and as I have seen the impact on white people of some of these other historical entities, and as I have seen white people respond to circumstances like the Trayvon Martin killing and others, I realize that there are absolutely, Ms. Washington, there absolutely are a lot of white people who need healing from racism. And I'm not talking about healing meaning that they are racist and they need to be healed of it. I'm saying that white people have been damaged by the institutionalized racism in our country as much as, or maybe I won't say as much, but certainly they have been damaged just as we have been damaged, differently, but they have been damaged by it as well. Would you agree with that?
I agree, because I'm going to tell a story about this 80-year-old man that his daughter had to bring from South Carolina when he heard the museum had opened. He was born in Paint Rock, and he made it to the first pew in the back and just sat down and started saying, "Please forgive my forefathers for what they done." He said, "Although these 9 lives were spared that day, it was a killing and a hanging in Paint Rock. We don't know how many was killed that day. We know it was 46 on the train, but did 46 make it to the jailhouse?" So as a young boy, he witnessed this, and he came back crying and asking for forgiveness of what his forefathers have done.
I imagine that if we were to really examine this and think about not only these historical circumstances like the one you just talked about with Paint Rock and the Scottsboro Boys, but if we even just think about all of the lynchings that occurred and understanding that lynchings in many cases were communal events where people would come out by the hundreds and sometimes the thousands, and I'm talking about white people, to watch these events and to almost party, if you will, around these events, that there is a residue of guilt and shame and hurt and confusion that resides in many white people today, who either because they were there at some of these events or because they were told about it by their ancestors who have now passed on, who are living with this grief, this shame, this guilt, this anger. And they need healing as well.
They need healing, and it's from the inside out. They have carried this around so many years till this museum, I call it a place of healing and restoration. You can come there and as the song says, lay your burdens at the altar. Just like the Matt Warren family, the grandchildren of the sheriff that got killed for protecting the Scottsboro Boys. They came there 5 years crying, no place to go other than the museum. And then he contacted me a couple of months ago asking if they could hang their grandfather's picture in the museum to give them something to remember him by. We had a memorial service for them and for the community, and we invited the judges and different ones. And as usual, they didn't show up, but we had a good turnout. Now the judge has his place on the wall with the boys he protected that night.
So we have...
I'm sorry, the sheriff.
The sheriff, right.
Yes.
Right, the sheriff. So we have in this story, in this horrific story, the main characters are, in this true history, the main characters are the 9 Scottsboro Boys, the women who accused them, right?
Yes.
We also have the sheriff who died trying to protect them. Who was killed. I shouldn't say died. He was killed trying to protect them from a lynching, right?
Yes.
And then we have the judge who presided over the case ultimately, right?
Right.
Why don't you, I gave a very cursory summary of the case. Why don't you give, as only you can do, I think, an extended retelling of what happened on that fateful day.
It was March the 25th, 1931. 9 black young men boarded the train in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The source of transportation at the time was hopping a train, and they call them hobos. And a fight broke out between 2 white boys and 4 black boys. And they were trying to overthrow the black boys off the train. And the reason that the 9 black boys that I know of and maybe the others were on their way to find work in Memphis. And there was 2 girls sitting at the front of the train who lived in Huntsville, Victoria Price and Ruby Bakes, who was known as prostitutes. They were so poor they had to live in the black community of Huntsville. They stayed with black people. they prostituted with black men. But as soon as that train stopped, and Victoria Price, who was 21, had just gotten out of jail for committing adultery, didn't want to go back to jail. And she told Ruby Bakes to follow what she says. And she tells the sheriff, are you going to take me to jail after what they did to me? And he said, what'd they do? They raped me. And she said, who? And at randomly, those nine boys was picked out of the group as the one who supposedly had raped them.
So these two women, white women from Huntsville, were on a train coming from, going to Memphis.
They were on a train coming back from Chattanooga.
Oh, coming back from Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. Do we know why they were in Chattanooga?
Prostituting.
Okay, so that's just what they did.
Right.
Okay. And you're saying that they lived in the black section of Huntsville. And that their clients were mainly black men.
Black men.
So they were outcasts in the white community, I would assume, right?
Yes. They were poor. Very poor. So at that time, I guess they mixed and mingled together, the poorest of the poor. They were poor. They lived with black people down on Holmes Avenue, back in that area of town at the time. And where the railroad depot was,
right,
is where they would get on the train.
So these two white women, like the others in question, the nine black men, the Scottsboro boys, they had all gotten on the train without paying. And
yes,
that's why they were going to be arrested, right?
They had gotten on the train to go to Memphis to find work. And the white boys wanted to overthrow them and said, this is a white man's train only.
Mm-hmm.
And you in to get off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to throw them off. And that's when the fight started.
Oh, so they were going to be arrested for the fight.
Yes.
Oh, I see. And so then that's when she said,
well, when the train stopped in Paint Rock.
Right.
And she saw the posse, the sheriff, and everybody waiting. Then she concocted this story that they had been raped.
To try to keep herself from going back to jail.
Going back to jail.
Hmm. So she was alleging that she had been gang raped on the train.
Gang raped.
On the train.
On the train.
Okay.
On top of gravels.
Right. Which doesn't make a
lot of sense. Broad daylight.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
No.
Yeah. Doesn't make a lot of sense to us, but the sheriff at the time bought it.
Yes.
And what happened after that?
Well, the mob wanted to kill him, and it's an eerie feeling when you go to Paint Rock. 1933, a tornado came through and wiped out the little town of Paint Rock, and they called it the curse of the Scottsboro Boys. The only thing left standing of that depot is the concrete slab, and we done a documentary there 2 years ago. And when you look back in the field where the water is, you can almost feel it where some men tried to run and get away, and they shot them down.
Eerie feeling in that area.
Yes, it's an eerie feeling back there where the train stopped. And when the white man that told us that it wasn't a hanging that day, but some black people were killed, and you look out across and you see a big field, they were trying to make their way get away. And that's what I said. We don't know how many blacks have died on their way to find work just because of the Jim Crow era that they could get away from killing a black man for anything. Just like the Emmett Till story. The woman finally confessed that it didn't happen.
Right. Right.
Just like the Scottsboro Boys story. Eventually, Victoria Price on her dying bed confessed that it didn't happen.
Hmm. When did she make that confession?
She made that confession in 1986, I think, in Huntsville Hospital.
So the sheriff arrests these nine men for allegedly raping these two white women. Can you give us the names of the men?
Roy Wright, Andy Wright, two brothers, Haywood Patterson, Clarence Noyce, Ozzy Powell, Willie Robinson, Charlie Wings, Eugene Williamson, and Olin Montgomery.
Okay. Now, was that Eugene Williams or Williamson?
Williamson.
Williams. Okay, that's what I thought. Eugene Williams. So they were arrested, and what happened to them after they were arrested?
No records of anything to be found anymore. Mostly they arrested everyone that was on the train. All we know is about the 9 Scottsboro boys, whom they got the name Scottsboro boys because of the trial that was held here in Scottsboro. None of them were from Scottsboro. And so the records shows no indication of how many was on the train that day. But the preacher at the church that I'm at now, back in 1931, him and the deacon, Mr. John Sanford, was the only two that could go and see those boys while they were locked up in Scottsboro. And they said it was 46 that was locked up. They let some of them go. Like I said, some of them might have got killed. But that night, after the boys was brought in from Paint Rock to Scottsboro, a mob came. And they had went and got a telephone pole, was going to knock the door down to get in. And the sheriff steps out and say, before you can get to them, you have to get to me. And he took his gun off and walked in the middle of the crowd and went down the middle of the crowd, and none of the men touched him, and sent his deputy to the courthouse to call the governor to activate the National Guard to protect those boys.
What's the name of the sheriff again?
Matt One.
Matt?
One. W-A-N-N.
W-A-N-N, okay. What a brave man.
He was. And he was only on the job 3 months before this happened.
And he was killed that night?
No, he was killed 1 year later month
Oh.
That the boys were arrested, ambushed by his own men.
But he was killed because he had protected them and still protecting them. The boys, the Scottsboro boys, were still in the same jail?
They were still there for a couple of weeks in Scottsboro, and he knew he had to move them. So they moved them to Birmingham.
So he was killed not in the act of protecting them, but in retaliation for protecting them. Wow, okay. What do we know about him?
The ceremony brought out a lot of that I didn't know about him. And I was thinking, was it about the Scottsboro boys? Or was it about the sheriff protecting the Scottsboro boys? Him getting killed 1 year later in the same month,
right,
March, for standing up protecting the boys?
And I'm curious to know, for a white man to do so at that particular time in history makes you question, well, did he do it because he believed so strongly in the rule of law? Or did he do it because he also had some sort of empathy for black people? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of what was his motivation for
that. What I was told was that they couldn't find a sheriff to run, and they had asked him to run. He was only 23 years old. And so they had asked him to run for sheriff. And him being a good sheriff, I picture him as an Andy Griffith.
Okay. Right. Trying to be fair to everybody.
Yeah, fair to everybody.
And keep the law. Keep the law.
Keep the law. Maintain the law.
Yeah.
And before that had happened a couple of months ago, it was a hanging in South Carolina where a white woman had accused 3 black men of raping her. And they broke the jailhouse door down and they arrested 2 and 1 got away. And that picture is on the front of Jet Magazine, Ebony Magazine, and you see them standing there laughing and having a good time at that hanging.
Yeah, this, without question, this was the evil of the time, that people did not allow the rule of law to prevail. They just took the law into their own hands and assumed the guilt of people because of their race. And this was routinely done throughout the country. James Cameron, I don't know. Do you know the story of James Cameron?
No.
James Cameron was the only known African-American person to survive a lynching. James Cameron, and folks who are listening can Google his name, C-A-M-E-R-O-N. He was also honored by President Bill Clinton at some point during Clinton's tenure. I don't remember the year. But James Cameron was jailed for allegedly, if I remember correctly, he was jailed in Indiana, southern Indiana, allegedly for killing a white woman or raping a white woman or something. And it was something that he maintained his innocence, of course. And to make a long story short, there was a day when a mob of, I think, a few thousand people gathered, surrounded the jailhouse, and James was also, or Mr. Cameron, I should say, was also involved in the case in which he was charged. There was also, I think, one or two other people involved, if I remember correctly. So there were two lynchings prior to his lynching. And that mob was there to lynch these three people, these other two men whose names I can't remember, and Mr. Cameron. And so they lynched the other two men. And then they went to get Mr. Cameron. And they marched him out of the jail and put a rope around his neck. And Mr. Cameron, in his own testimony, says that he heard a voice from heaven. That's what he says. And he says he heard a voice say, "Don't do this to this man. He didn't have anything to do with what happened." And then he said he looked out on this mass of people, and there was some sort of a change that he saw in the people, you know, after hearing this voice. And he said that one of the men, I guess maybe one of the leaders, came up, took the rope from off of his neck, and led him through the crowd, and the crowd parted and let him leave. It's an amazing story. You should really look, you know, being the founder of the museum and with your sense of Black history, you should really look up James Cameron, and that's an amazing story. But anyway, I brought that up just simply to say that these sorts of acts and these sorts of attempts to preempt justice were not unusual. They were very commonplace. So, getting back to the Scottsboro Boys, these men, you said, were moved to Birmingham. And then how long did it take for them to go to trial?
Trials lasted for a total of 7 years.
So there were multiple trials.
Multiple trials.
And why was that? Why were there multiple trials?
Well, let me take that back. It was three trials in Decatur. They tried each one of them separately. Sometimes they would try Haywood and Clarence North together. The stories wouldn't work out. They hated Haywood because he was the smartest and the most radical of all of them.
Mm.
And then they would have the other boys on trial. So the trials lasted a period of almost 7 years. And at that time, they went from young teenagers to grown men into their 30s. So 6 years after the arrest is when the doctor finally confessed to the judge and to the lawyers that the girls had never been raped.
The doctor confessed it. So he had done a medical examination of the women and found that there had been no sexual activity.
They had had sex the night before with their boyfriends, and he put it in a way that the semen was multi-dead, and that if 9 Black men would have raped 2 white women, that the sperm should still be alive. No bruising or cutting or tearing on either one of the women.
Okay, so in other words, the medical evaluation was that it was medically impossible that they could have been raped.
Exactly. He said they were laughing and talking when they came into the office.
Okay, so he also just observed their behavior. They didn't behave like women who had been raped.
Right.
Okay. But it took him 6 years to reveal this.
6 years to reveal it.
Do we know why he finally did?
Well, one thing, one of the doctor's daughters is still alive. And she said that they called her daddy a coward because he testified and told the truth. But he had started a practice and he didn't want to be burned out.
Hmm. Because if he had spoken in defense of the Scottsboro Boys,
he would probably have been killed also.
Right. Because, again, that's what they did in those days.
Exactly.
Okay. So here we are 6 years or so later. When does this case start to turn in the favor of the Scottsboro Boys, and how?
It turned when they got out of prison, four of them, because it was only nine. Five was still in. They let four go that same day that the doctor told them that no rape had occurred.
They just arbitrarily picked the four?
Picked the four. They picked the youngest one, the one that had the sexual transmitted disease, and the one that needed glasses, and one more.
Okay.
So immediately, the Jewish lawyer got him on a train and got him to New York City.
Oh, we forgot about him. What is his name?
Samuel Lee Wood.
And how did this man come to defend the Scottsboro Boys?
The ILD, which was the International Labor Defense Team, which was a communist organization, said that they had to get the best lawyer possible. And they can call it propaganda or whatever, but they had sneaked two ILD employees into the courtroom to listen to the trials. And when they saw how these boys was getting railroaded, they said, we're going to show the United States that we treat our blacks better than the United States treat their blacks.
And this is interesting and fascinating to me, because I think this is around the same general time period that Paul Robeson was being blacklisted by the United States for allegedly having communist ties. He wasn't able to perform. You know, Paul Robeson, the classical music opera star, was not able to perform in the United States and earn a living because he was perceived to have been a communist. I think this is around the same general time period. It may not be exactly line up, but the same general time period. So there was this sort of tension between the communist movement, which was openly sympathetic to the civil rights of African Americans, which is why Robeson didn't, I don't think he ever said overtly that he was a communist. He also never disavowed communism, because he pointed to communism as being sympathetic to civil rights. So this is interesting to me, because this is evidence, in fact, of that truth, that the communist movement was sympathetic to civil rights. And it was a difficult thing, I think, for many, at least in my mind as I read history, it's a difficult thing to totally condemn communism, understanding the communists were supportive of our people at a time when our own government wasn't.
That's true, because either you were dirt poor communist or you were filthy rich American. So the communists took this case up, and the first fundraiser of any case to raise money for these boys and the defense team was 1 cent stamps that they sold at picnics and different things in New York City. And New York is where everything happened and rolled down to the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this is the first civil rights movement, the Scottsboro Boys case. And I have this thing with them wanting to put Rosa Parks' face out there as the mother of the civil rights movement, when she sat down on a bus and was trained how to do so.
Yeah.
And how to handle the spitting on and all of that. These boys didn't have any training.
That's a great point.
So why is it that they can't recognize the Scottsboro Boys? It's not a pretty case to talk about, but it's the best case to talk about, because it set up the movement of the civil rights movement, and then it set up two United States Supreme Court rulings for all people.
And explain that, too, real quickly.
The United States Supreme Court rulings?
Yes, ma'am.
One was when they had the trial in Scottsboro. They didn't think blacks was qualified to serve. They were too dumb and ignorant and unlearned. So what happened was they saw the jury roll book. And like I said, Mr. John Sanford, who was one of the only black men to see the Scottsboro Boys at the time, was a very educated man and a businessman. And when they took the roll book up to the United States Supreme Court in Washington, He testified that he could serve if he would have been asked. And so what happened was the United States Supreme Court ruled in favor that because they didn't have any blacks on the jury, that it had to go before Scottsboro again in 1933 when they put the first black person on the grand jury.
Okay.
And so that poor black man didn't want to serve on the grand jury. The state appointed him, and his voice meant nothing.
But it did. But your point is that the Supreme Court ruling is what helped to integrate the jury process.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so with him being, they picked him from Paint Rock. So he went on and done his jury duty. But in the meantime, he was scared to death that him and his family would be killed.
Sure. They weren't, though, right?
No.
Okay. And what is the other Supreme Court case?
The other one was that they had a real estate attorney. The parents raised $66 between the four parents from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they sent a real estate attorney down here on a criminal trial to represent those boys. And he went in there and spent less than 10 minutes and told them to plead guilty. And he got drunk and came out and laid his head on the table. Because he saw the mob outside.
Right.
And it scared him just as bad.
So the Supreme Court ruling was what?
Due process. Okay. And a lawyer has to know your case before he can represent you.
Okay. So in other words, there were appeals, and I guess the Jewish lawyer, and I'm sorry, give me his name again.
Samuel Leibowitz.
Yeah, Samuel Leibowitz. Mr. Leibowitz, he actually, I guess, filed appeals based on these problems, and then it went up to the Supreme Court, and that's how these rulings were then in favor not only of the Scottsboro boys, but also future cases.
Future cases.
Okay.
And when I say that, you know, this should be a case where everybody should celebrate or look at as to this case set up the precedents in the courtroom. If not this case, when? This was already 1931, 33, 36, and here we are still having no blacks, no persons of color serving on the jury.
Okay, so we have four Scottsboro boys released. And of course, we're saying boys, but they were no longer boys at this point. None of them were. They were released based on the doctor's testimony that the women medically provable that they hadn't been raped. And then his observations of their behavior also indicated they hadn't been raped. So the judge decides to release four of the men, but there's still five in prison. When were the other five released?
They were released over a period of time when the governor felt like they should be released.
Which sounds to me like an injustice, a gross injustice.
Another gross injustice.
Right.
The newspaper, Oliver, I forget his last name, he was the one big person behind the Scottsboro Boys movement that kept them in jail for a period of time. And he said, how can four be innocent and five be guilty when nine was convicted of rape?
Right.
So he started turning, and it began to help the Scottsboro Boys with his newspaper articles out of Montgomery.
Okay. So he was writing those articles.
Yes.
And that was beginning to change public opinion.
Exactly.
Okay. You also indicated the mothers of the Scottsboro boys were very active and intentional in trying to fight for the rights of their sons, even to the point of going up to the White House. Can you tell that story real quickly?
Miss Patterson, Haywood Patterson's mother, led a march in front of the White House of about 5,000 people. And the president at that time was Mr. Roosevelt, and his wife was Eleanor. He would not sit down and talk with them. But the story is told that he met privately with the governor of Alabama over in Stonewall, Georgia.
Okay.
To release the boys.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Now, was this before or after Mrs. Roosevelt entertained Mr. Haywood's mother with tea?
It doesn't say, but she entertained the mothers. It was about four or five of the mothers.
Oh, four or five of them.
And listen to this. Ruby Bakes, who changed her story after the trial of Scottsboro, saying that the rape never happened. She was also on a mission with the Scottsboro boys' mother to help free the Scottsboro boys.
Wow. Okay.
So she marched in front of the White House with the mothers.
With the mothers. Wow. That's just mind-boggling. That's just mind-boggling that she would be accepted, because she was part of the reason that they were in the plight they were in.
Exactly. Wow. But she became a communist.
Oh, really?
And she apologized for what she had said. And you will see her on stage with the mothers in Madison Square Garden and different places. And she got to see the world while Victoria Price had to stay back here in Alabama and hold on to the lie. And so the attorney for the state of Alabama told Ruby, you either lied in Scottsboro or you lying now. So her testimony in Decatur that those boys never raped them, they made a fool out of her.
Wow. There are so many layers to this story.
It is. It's mind-boggling. I mean, you can't comprehend it all.
Right.
You pick up a book to read it, and it gets to where you have to put it down and come back and pick it up again.
Well, this is why I think all of us need to make our way to Scottsboro, Alabama, to your museum, so that we can get the full gist of the story and understand why this is not just an important piece of African-American history, but American history.
It is the most important part of American history. We do have some artifacts that was actually in the jail cell with the Scottsboro boys, the actual table that they sat around, and I can imagine them discussing their case sitting at that table. A guard, deputy, had saved it and had it in his yard as a picnic table. And then we had a family to give us a chair that was used during the trial. And one of the chairs was used during the jury trial, and the other chair was used as a testimony trial when the boys was put on the stand to testify. So we have had whites to give us property, and we just had a lady to contact me yesterday that has a 1930 Ford newspaper article from the New York Times that she wants to donate to the museum.
Beautiful. I would be remiss if, before ending the podcast, if we did not talk about the personal commitment that you've made and what this has cost you, because this journey in establishing this museum 9 years ago wasn't an easy journey for you. You paid a price, did you not?
I did.
Talk about your story. Talk about what you went through.
Process of me wanting to do something for the Scottsboro boys after reading the book at 17, 18, reading it again and getting the feel of it all. I worked at City Hall, and I overheard him say he was going to put a historical walking trail. And I butted in and I said, well, wouldn't it be good if we could do something for the Scottsboro boys? And the mayor at the time pointed his finger at my nose and said, leave that dead dog sleeping, and you better not do anything to resurrect it. So in retaliation, I lost my job after 22 years and lost my retirement. I like 3 years from doing so. And I was humiliated by being placed from the front where I could be seen to the back facing a wall.
Before they fired you?
Yes.
So they isolated you?
They isolated me. Mm-hmm. Also, the town wasn't in favor of it. Now, some of the older blacks said, why don't you close that museum down? All it's going to do is cause problems, and we don't need that. That's old. Why do you want to bring it up? I said, because it's history. It's our history.
Hmm. So the museum today stands and has been standing for 9 years. It is in the former historic Joyce Chapel United Methodist Church, which is the oldest standing African-American church in Jackson County, which is where Scottsboro is. Because it's been around for 9 years, it's a success.
It's right? a success. I was told in a meeting when I had to meet with this powers to be in the Scottsboro, the people that held the money, that we wouldn't last a year. They would make sure that we wouldn't last a year.
So they were planning to, they were threatening to run you out of business.
Yes.
And instead, you're standing 9 years later.
Standing 9 years later.
You're also on the Alabama Civil Rights Trail, right? Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Talk real quickly about the significance of that.
We're one of the only museums in the northeast part of Alabama that's on the Civil Rights Trail. And we have people to come as far away as New Zealand to come and see the museum.
Being on the Civil Rights Trail is significant because there is a growing, and has been for some time, a growing civil rights industry, if you will, in the state because of the history, because of Selma and Birmingham and Scottsboro and things that have even happened in Huntsville and Montgomery. So to be connected to that means that people who are looking to tour the state and learn that history, just as they will visit Selma and Birmingham and Montgomery, they will visit Scottsboro.
Yes. And part of the history of that church being historical is that Rosa Parks' husband, Raymond, came there in 1932 to try to start an NAACP. And the Ku Klux Klan got after him so bad he had to go into hiding for 2 months and sell his car to make it back to Montgomery.
Wow. And so he was in hiding in Scottsboro.
In Scottsboro. And when you hear the story of the Rosa Parks when she comes on, that's the first thing they're talking about is the Scottsboro Boys case. And when she gets out there and start protesting, and he tells her, don't you go out there and get yourself in trouble like them Scottsboro boys done down in Scottsboro. But as soon as their house get bombed, he moves her to Detroit, Michigan.
Right. Right. Wow.
But he was there in that church trying to start an NAACP.
How about that? So much we don't know still. I hadn't heard that story. So much we don't know. About how African-American people were targeted by the most virulent expressions of racism, sometimes to their death, other times to just being injured or frightened or whatever. It took a lot of strength and courage to survive those times, and that's part of our history. It takes a lot of strength and courage to stand up to the powers that be in your city and to establish a museum that they did not want to see established, and to maintain it to this day, 9 years later. Ms. Washington, I want to thank you, not just for being on the podcast today, but I want to thank you for what you have done, what you have sacrificed in order to ensure that this history is told and preserved so that we can know it, so that all of us, whether black or white, can get the healing and reconciliation that we need so that we can move forward, hopefully, a better people. Thank you so much for what you've done.
Thank you, David, for having me here today.
Sheila Washington is the founder of the Scottsboro Boys Museum in Scottsboro, Alabama. If you want to visit that museum, it is at 428 West Willow Street, 428 West Willow Street, in what was formerly the historic Joyce Chapel United Methodist Church. And, of course, many folks go to Scottsboro because they want to go to that store, Unclaimed Baggage. Well, the museum is one block east of Unclaimed Baggage. So you're open at the museum the second and third Saturdays of the month, or even more than that?
Even more than that. When we have appointments, people can call and make appointments, bring groups, or whatever.
Okay. So to do that, how can they best reach you?
256-609-4202.
Okay. 256-609-4202. Or you can visit her website, which is ScottsboroBoysMuseum.org.
Right.
Beautiful. Beautiful. That's the website, ScottsboroBoysMuseum.org. Miss Washington, again, thank you very much for joining us for the Healthy Alabama Podcast today.
Thank you.
The Healthy Alabama Podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama and produced in partnership with Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU. Our theme music was produced by my man, DJ Bailey. And again, I want to just say one more time, it's worth the trip to Scottsboro to see this museum, to learn this history. And you can do that by visiting the website, ScottsboroBoysMuseum.org, or by calling Miss Washington at 256-609-4202. It's an important part of history that we need to support the commemoration of and the preservation of. All right. That's it for this episode of the Healthy Alabama Podcast. Until next time, be healthy.